Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
If you're an avid listener of the podcast, you know that I love movies. I enjoy referencing them in the podcast episodes. I've seen some bad ones, I've seen some good ones, and I've seen ones that are so bad, they're actually good. And that's what I want to talk about today here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. There are some films that are just bad. They're insufferable to watch. They're technically awful. They're unwatchable films. But that's not the kind of film that I am talking about today. I'm talking about films that strive for some kind of a good end, a particular end, like a serious drama, and fail spectacularly in trying to achieve that end, that in the process, they unintentionally create some kind of comedic gold. Now, I've already referenced these films a little bit in the previous episode of Free For All Friday when I talked about overacted lines and ridiculous movie scenes. So you remember things like from Battlefield Earth, "While I was conquering galaxies," or The Room, which has been called the Citizen Kane of bad movies. "I did not kill her. I didn't do it. I did not." Oh, hi, Mock. Today, though, I want to talk about this, the Christian subgenre of this. And it's not just to knock on Christians who are trying hard to make films. We should encourage Christians in the arts. But we also shouldn't sugarcoat it that if someone has failed to meet the bar, I think it's important to point that out. That way, future films that Christians make will exceed those standards and not just be something that people laugh at. Because a common theme that you'll see in the movies that I'll talk about, at least 4 out of 5 of them, is that they strive for a particular message. They start with the message and then wrap the story around it. So instead of telling art, it's more akin to propaganda. Whereas authentic Christian art takes a timeless story or message that communicates themes about the love of God, the grace of God, and tells it with memorable characters with an important story, not cardboard characters that are used to essentially be a moving evangelical tract. So what I want to talk about then today are those movies that are essentially salvation tracts. You know, you go out in places and someone hands you a little chick tract, or even ones from like Ray Comfort, Living Waters. You know, it's the 4 spiritual laws. This is how you're saved. Some Christians, when they go out and make films, not all of them, but some have the idea that a film should just basically be a salvation tract and it doesn't come off as good art. And when it tries to be something serious, because it's either poorly directed, poorly acted, has a bad script, you can have unintentional comedic gold so bad that it's good. Before I get into that, though, I want to remind you, please visit TrenthornPodcast.com to get access to bonus content and to support the podcast so that we can bring in other guests and be doing dialogues with atheists coming soon on our miracles, something rational people can believe in. Is the Bible historically reliable? I think these dialogues are important to show people how to engage those who disagree about the faith. And those dialogues, by the way, I have found people have told me they're great episodes to send to your non-Catholic friends, to your non-Christian friends, because it's not just Trent Horn pontificating here. It's actual dialogues with people who disagree. And these can be great things for people to listen to who are still on the fence or even opposed to the faith, but are willing to give our faith a fair hearing. So be sure to check that out. Consider supporting the podcast for as little as $5 a month to keep us going. That is at TrentHornPodcast.com. Now, on to my top 5 Christian films. So bad, they're actually good. I want to start, though, with honorable mentions, a group of films by Affirm Films. They're films made by the same people. These include Facing the Giants, Fireproof, Courageous. I don't know if War Room is a part of that or not, but they're all kind of made by the same company. And I give them credit that these films at least have increased in value, in production value, in acting. But I've always had problems with some of these films. Like Facing the Giants, the theme is, oh, your football team is losing, your truck won't start, your wife won't get pregnant, just believe in Jesus and all those problems will go away. Now, it's not put that bluntly, but that's kind of the theme that comes from it. And that's why I'm none too happy about that film. In fact, in my book, Counterfeit Christ, I talk about prosperity theology and I reference watching a movie with these themes. I'm talking about Facing the Giants. Their sequel to that, Fireproof, is better because it has Kirk Cameron in it. And don't worry, folks, Kirk Cameron will be back on the list. He's in the top 5, but he also has a spot in the honorable mentions. Fireproof is a movie about a guy trying to save his marriage from divorce and growing as a person in that result, growing in faith, becoming a better husband. So the movie's better because Kirk Cameron is actually an actor. He can act. I loved him on Growing Pains as rascally Mike Seaver. Also, a young Leonardo DiCaprio was on Growing Pains, if you remember that. And Alan Thicke, who I think one of these Free For All Fridays, I'm going to do top 5 sitcom dads, Alan Thicke from Growing Pains is easily going to take one of the top five spots for me, probably along with Carl Winslow from Family Matters and maybe Patrick Duffy from Step by Step. Step by step, day by day, fresh start on this and that. Sorry, when I talk about these old TV shows, it's the theme songs that always parade, barge into my mind when I think of them. But so those Affirm films with Kirk Cameron later on, Courageous, they get better and better, but they're not the highest quality art. But they make honorable mentions for me. They haven't made my top five list. So, all right, let's start with the list then. Number five, God's Not Dead. It's a 2014 film. This film actually met with a lot of financial success for its budget. It was made with about $2 million, and it ended up in the box office bringing in like $64 million. That is a huge box office success. And a lot of Christians like this film. But I know a lot of other Christians who say, I like it in principle, but it's really overdone and kind of cringy and cheesy in part. So the film is about a young man who's going to college. His name's Josh Wheaton, and he enrolls in the philosophy class with like the campus's notorious atheist professor, played by Kevin Sorbo, who demands everybody in class agree that God is dead, which is ironic, of course, because Kevin Sorbo played a literal mythological god in the television series Hercules, which is awesome, by the way. So that's part of it. There's also a subplot with Dean Cain. When you start looking at these Christian films, are these same Christian actors that start to pop up in them that used to be famous in television or film and got more into the Christian industry? And I actually like them. I love Dean Cain. I love Kevin Sorbo. It's neat to see them in this venue. So the idea is the movie is just about this philosophy student battling this atheist professor and debating him in class. But the problem is all the acting is just kind of cringy and people talk. And one problem with Christian films is people talk in ways that you don't actually talk in real life. It sounds like people who are rehearsing lines for a play than actually having real dialogue with one another. Part of the problem is the bad script writing. The other part is usually bad delivery. But God's Not Dead is number five on my list because there are a lot of decent parts in this. Some of the arguments for God are actually pretty decent that are shared. There's one scene, though, in the movie that I think is really good, actually. It's one I'm like, wow, that's a really powerful scene. And even people writing in the scene is on YouTube. People have wrote down on it. I didn't like this movie except for this scene. And it's about Dean Cain, who is another character in the film. He's an atheist, and he goes to visit his mother, who has dementia. And he's just this proud, boastful atheist. And he's like, what do you have to teach me? You know, my life is perfect. I'm an atheist. You believe in God, and you're dying of dementia. What do you have to teach me? So I want to play the scene for you.
Prayed and believed your whole life. Never done anything wrong. And here you are. You're the nicest person I know. I am the meanest.
Also, so it's a dark room. She's just looking out a window. It's a nice moonlight lit, and she's just staring off into the distance, mouth agape, like his mom is just completely checked out, not home, which I want you to keep that image in your mind.
You have dementia. My life is perfect. Explain that to me.
Sometimes the devil allows people to live a life free of trouble, because he doesn't want them turning to God. Your sin is like a jail cell, except it's all nice and comfy, and there doesn't seem to be any need to leave. And the door's wide open. Till one day, time runs out. The cell door slams shut, and suddenly it's too late. Who did you say you were?
It gives me the shivers. He talks to his mother with dementia, who seems completely not there. Yet she tells him, which is really more God speaking through her, the Holy Spirit, the most sane thing that he could ever hear in his entire life. So that's good. That's great. Yay, filmmakers. Yay, good. This is good filmmaking. But then the rest of it's really cheesy, like really cheesy. So I'm going to play a little bit of the trailer and then fill you in on the other parts of the movie I'm not a big fan of.
Name? Wheaton. Josh Wheaton. Philosophy 150. You might want to think about a different instructor.
Come on, man. It can't be that bad.
Think Roman Colosseum. People cheering for your death.
I am Professor Radisson. This is Philosophy 150. I would like to bypass senseless debate altogether and jump to the conclusion, which every sophomore is already aware of, there is no God. All that I require from each of you is that you fill in the papers I've just given you with three little words. God is dead. Mr. Wheaton, is something wrong?
I can't do what you want. I'm a Christian.
If you cannot bring yourself to admit that God is dead, then you will need to defend the antithesis.
Think of Jesus as my friend.
You think Jesus is God?
I don't want to disappoint him.
So your acceptance of this challenge may be the only meaningful exposure to God and Jesus they'll ever have.
Now, first off, what's hard about this when I watch this is that Kevin Sorbo's atheist professor is really something from a Jack Chick tract. There are some professors who are extreme atheists who are unfair to their students, no doubt. One that comes to my mind is probably Peter Boghossian. So I don't know what he's like with his students, but I wouldn't be surprised by this. Peter Boghossian is a professor up in Oregon. He wrote a book called A Manual for Creating Atheists. And he says things like faith is pretending to know what you don't know, which is kind of it's a very uncharitable description of faith. He also says that people of faith who don't respond to arguments for atheism are brain damaged. So I mean, he's a very uncharitable person and he's a very outspoken person, but even him, I don't think would do what Kevin Sorbo's character does here, which says, all right, students, everybody say God is dead or else you're going to fail my class. It's just not that. I've never heard of it happening. And as the more interactions happen, it starts to stretch believability.
Hey, to me, he's not dead. I don't want anyone to get talked out of believing in him just because this professor thinks they should.
Mr. Wheaton, are you ready?
We're going to put God on trial.
You think you're smarter than me? Do not try to humiliate me in front of my students. In that classroom, there is a God. I'm him.
This experiment is over. You get to decide who the most important person in your life is. Me, Professor Radisson.
I love number one. That's where it goes over the top for me. Like, there is a God in this class, and it's me. I'm like, do people really say that? This is a bit over the top. And I love also the girlfriend. Are you going to take me seriously? We're talking about God and Professor Radisson's class. There's too much conflict in this movie for me to handle. But then, so here's how the movie ends. I'm going to spoil it for you because it's been out for 5 years. My spoiler rules are usually for about a few months after a movie comes out. So he defends God in class. And eventually, Josh gets Professor Radisson to say why he hates God. He's like, why do you hate God? He says, I hate God because he let my mother die or something like that. That's why I hate God. And then all the students end up walking out of class and they all believe in God. So there's a big concert with Newsboys at the end of the film, which is one of the two concerts, by the way, I've been to in my entire life. I've only been to two concerts. I went to a Newsboys concert, and then I went to a George Michael concert because the girl I was dating at the time, her parents had box seats. And so I went, and it was amazing when George Michael started riffing Careless Whisper at the end. And well, that's another story in and of itself. But at the end of the show, everyone's at this concert, and Professor Radisson, Kevin Sorbo, is on the street corner. He's about to walk across the street. He's trying to reconcile with his Christian girlfriend that he has. And then he gets hit by a car. And there's a preacher there. And the preacher talks to him. And Kevin Sorbo accepts Jesus before he dies. And then it cuts to the concert where everyone's like, I heard you have an atheist professor who's giving you a hard time. I want you all to text. God's not dead. And I'm like, the guy is dead. It's like we're dancing on his grave a little bit here at the end of the film. So bad it's good. Number five, God's not dead. Number four, Pamela's Prayer. Pamela's Prayer is one I couldn't find a trailer. It's one you've probably never heard of. The best man at my wedding showed me this film because he too likes movies that are so bad they're good. I was shocked that it was made in 1998 because sometimes with Christian films, I notice they tend to use not great filming technology. Like I thought this was shot back in the 70s, but it turns out it was filmed in 1998. And Pamela's Prayer is basically, I think it's more like a short film, honestly. It is about a single father whose wife dies in childbirth, and he raises his only daughter, Pamela, and he's trying to teach her how to be chaste. And it's just about how she navigates dating in high school, finding the right guy, and getting married, and waiting until she's married to even kiss another guy, and the importance of that. So it's a movie about promoting chastity, but it's really cringy with the acting and the pacing. There's one particular scene I have to share with you that just makes my hair stand on edge. So it starts with, you know, Pamela's earlier was talking to her dad, like, why can't I date? My friends date. And he just always talks like he is always in pastor mode. He never talks like a human being. Like, he's always giving a sermon, the father, every time he speaks. So he says, no, you can't date. You'll thank me later. And this is her in the library with one of her friends talking about this. And then it cuts to a scene with the dad. So let me play it.
So what kind of a guy does your dad want you to marry?
He wants me to marry a guy who's never kissed a girl.
He what?
He wants me to marry a guy who's never kissed a girl.
You're kidding.
Nope.
Pam, your dad wants you to marry a guy who doesn't exist.
He thinks he does.
So why won't he let you date?
He wants me to remain pure. He doesn't want me to be tempted to kiss anyone until my wedding day.
Wait a minute. Your dad wants you to wait until your wedding day to kiss a guy, and he wants your husband to wait until his wedding day to kiss a girl?
That's right. Jessica, please don't repeat that to anyone. Everybody thinks I'm weird enough as it is.
Don't worry, I won't. Pam, I like your dad and everything, but he's living in a dream world. What's this thing about kissing? I've kissed guys before and I don't feel bad. Kissing's fun. You're really missing out.
Also, at the end of the film, I think her friend, like, gets an STD or is, like, sexually assaulted or something where it's like, so your friend kissed a guy and... well, look what happened to him. But then she's talking to her dad. This is where the hair starts to stand on edge for me.
Jessica's father lets her go out with guys as long as they're Christians.
I wonder what Jessica's husband would say if he knew that.
What do you mean?
Pamela, whenever we come to a point in our lives when we're not sure what to do, we should always look ahead and view things from that perspective. For example, in your case about dating, let's look ahead to your wedding day. You'll be getting married to the man you love with all your heart. This is the man you're going to spend the rest of your life with. Now, let's go ahead a little further to your wedding night.
No, no, Dad, no. It's getting too creepy. Don't.
When you lie down on your wedding bed, what kind of a man do you want your husband to be? Do you want a man who saved all his love just for you? One who never even kissed another woman so he could share that just with you? Or do you want a man who's been with other women before? One who kissed other women and didn't wait for you. Which one would you prefer?
I would prefer you not talk about me laying down on my wedding bed, Dad. I'm sorry, but I can't handle that. The only thing I can't handle is that this kind of message I disagree with. Obviously, we should practice chastity, but this mentality of saying, of having harsh legalism. Now, if someone thinks it's good for them to not kiss until marriage, then they should discern that with their own conscience. I'm not going to tell them they're wrong, necessarily. But I will say that if you are acting in a way just to adhere to a kind of legalistic standard to please others, you could end up in unhealthy relationships, unhealthy fixations on others, and not even develop self-control for yourself in marriage. So I also don't like that the movie preaches a kind of destructive purity culture that is a poor substitute for living authentic chastity and authentic virtue when it comes to dating and marriage, things like that. All right, number three is Dark Dungeons. I talked about this on Free For All Friday 2 weeks ago when I talked about Harry Potter. I was conflicted about including this film because the filmmakers are satirizing a Jack Chick tract about role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons. So on the one hand, it's not a Christian movie because the people making it are making fun of Christian films. But on the other hand, it is a Christian film because Jack Chick gave permission for his tract to be adapted, provided that it was adapted faithfully. So you could act Chick and the person who made these anti-Dungeons & Dragons tracts saying, what kind of a movie do you want to show people? What if you wanted a Christian movie to show why Dungeons and Dragons is sinful and dangerous, what movie would you want? He would say, I would want Dark Dungeons. So I think it meets the bar of saying that Dark Dungeons is a Christian film because the people who made it, they're making a satire, but they play it straight, which makes it really funny to watch. but the source material is very earnest, and those who provided the material are happy with the film. It exactly communicates the message that they want to communicate. But in doing so, it's so over the top, and I love it. So I'm going to play the trailer. Here we go.
You must trust me without hesitation, for this is the most important adventure of your very lives.
Are you ready to RPG?
Yeah!
One goal, and one goal only. To stay in the game.
Let's get ready to RPG!
Who are you?
So I love that they're at, like, it looks like a frat party with red cups. RPG, remember, stands for role-playing games, Dungeons and Dragons. And usually that's just like eight guys in somebody's basement playing with dice. It's not like a college party with all the jocks and cheerleaders there shouting, drinking, and saying, let's RPG. I do not believe there has ever been a role-playing game party in the history of mankind that looked like the one in this film. But then it begins, are you really into your role for this role-playing game?
I'm Marcy.
No, you are not Marcy. Who are you?
I'm Blackleaf, the thief of the shadows.
RPG! 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 RPG!
Maybe we should go. That senior warned us about playing RPGs.
Using RPGs to fight evil will never work because RPGs are evil.
Spells?
I think your hands are perfect for spellcasting. There's so much that you could do with them.
Poison? Battles? Killing?
I'm going to die?
Yeah, but it's all imagination.
Is it?
And thanks to the power of the subconscious, they will begin to live it for real.
So the idea here is that it becomes real for these people, and then one of them actually dies in the process of playing the game in real life. They can cast real spells, and then at the end, they're saved by Jesus. But there was one clip that really was emblematic of bad acting in general, which pops up a lot in some of these lower budget Christian films. Maybe we shouldn't be here. That senior warned us about this. It's a particular cadence of bad acting in films that you have this weird tempo. Hey, Judy, what's going on? Even that, like, I'm not a professional actor. I would probably botch things. But in a film, it's like, hey, Judy, what's going on? Like, that is, it's just so not real. Come on, people. There are great actors out there, great people of faith who are actors. Get them to apply their acting talents for the good of the kingdom. All right, we're coming on the top two. The top two films, so bad, it's good. Number two is See Me Dance, 2009. And the title is the letter C, then me and dance. See Me Dance. All right, so what is this about? So you play the trailer. It's about a girl who, okay, I'll just put the plot out there, then we'll listen to the trailer. It's about a girl who wants to be in the Pittsburgh Ballet. And it turns out she can't because she's dying of leukemia. But then it turns out that she's been given a gift by God that anyone she touches becomes Christian. And this upsets the devil so much, he comes to Earth and stalks her and tries to kill her. That's the movie. So when you watch the trailer, it starts, it seems like kind of a hopeful drama. So here's how the trailer goes.
I just wanted to dance and hang out, Dad. And now all of this.
Unfortunately, she's in the advanced stages and treatment's not going to help. I'm sorry.
When you looked at me, I saw God.
I know this sounds weird, Sri, but it's as if God has chosen you. And if that's the truth, man, this is gonna tick off the devil.
And then, so it seems like a hopeful drama, and then the trailer takes a sharp left turn into horror.
Yes, I do.
Remember a serpent? The disguised as a dove.
What do you know of hell, creature?
All right, so then they battle the devil, and then at the end, everything seems fine. And for some reason, she gets a personalized license plate, C, the letter C, me dance, as like a gift at the end. So now we see the title. And then she dies anyways. And the dad's like, screaming to God, "We did everything you asked." Like, okay. And then there's just a vision of her in heaven dancing for her mother. And that's the movie, folks. But check out the trailer online, See Me Dance. Like, it's fairly disliked, but not as bad as the number one Christian film, So Bad It's Good. This movie, by the way, that I'm going to share with you, the number one spot for me, is so bad. It has the lowest ranking on IMDb.com. The lowest ranking. It's got like 13,000 one-star votes. And both Christians and atheists do not like this movie. And the movie is the 2014 film Saving Christmas, starring Kirk Cameron. So what is this film about? I'll just summarize you right here. It's about Kirk Cameron going to a Christmas party, talking to his brother-in-law in the car about why Christmas is important. There's a flashback about the nativity, and then they have a dance party inside the house. That's the movie. And so the idea here, it's just about dealing with people, especially even other Christians who say, well, Christmas is commercialized and it's pagan and I don't want to have anything to do with it, which is an important theme to address. But it's almost like this is like a 10-minute instructional. This could have been a 10-minute instructional video on a website, not a full-length film. And it's just so cringy as it goes through, especially as Kirk Cameron, the more and more he explains why our modern celebration of Christmas, how it parallels in everything we do, even if it's kind of extravagant or commercialized, is okay, because that's the spirit of Christmas. So here's the trailer.
Do you ever feel like Christmas has been hijacked?
Hey, where's Christian? How's he doing? Is he okay?
Oh, he's fine, really. He's just not into Christmas this year, that's all.
By all the commercialism and those who want to replace Merry Christmas with Happy Holidays or Season's Greetings, whatever that means.
You okay?
This is not what Christmas is all about.
Some want to pull down every manger scene and tell us why our favorite Christmas traditions are wrong.
Newsflash, not in the Bible. That's a pagan idol symbol.
It was the winter solstice. Jesus was not born in December.
It's exactly what the Druids did.
It's like a carjacking, but like of our religion. And guess what? Santa got in the car, kicked Jesus out, and was like, rolling, 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 and took it.
Isn't it time somebody...
Already I'm having trouble getting through this, but let's keep going.
Spoke up. Everything you see inside there, it's all about Christmas. It's all about Jesus. I know you love Christmas and you want it to be all about what it's all about.
So then he goes on and he talks about, but the imagery he makes, because obviously you might be thinking, well, Trent, this is good. We should get people to see that Christmas is important. Absolutely. But not in such a heavy-handed way. First, the film quality is really weird. Like, there's a lot of takes. It seems like a long, extended take. Like, there's one where Kirk Cameron reaches for his hot chocolate, like, three times and doesn't know what he's doing, which is clearly they made a mistake, but they didn't bother to redo the take. Or the scene in the car where he's talking to his brother-in-law, that goes on forever, and it's the same two shots cycling back and forth with one another. So he explains this, but some of the explanations really strain credulity. He's like, everything, when you take the little nutcracker dolls, put them next to the tree, they symbolize Herod's troops that were going after to kill Jesus. And presents are great. Buy expensive presents. You should have towers of gifts, because those represent the towers of Jerusalem at the first Christmas. And you're like, wait a minute, how much further are we going on with this? So it's a decent enough message carried out in such a heavy-handed way, and then it ends with a cheesy dance-off at the end of the house. But that's the film. That's the whole film. It could have been done in a 10-minute thing. So to get the idea of it, I'm going to play more of the trailer.
This Christmas, dive headfirst into all of the joy, the dancing, the celebration, the feasting, the imagination, and traditions that glorify the true reason for the season.
So like a third of the trailer is just the last 5 minutes of the dance-off in the film. Here's a clip of the New York Times, a review of the film. It says, of Kirk Cameron, "With a smile so wide and laughter that sounds so forced, you half expect the camera to pull back to reveal hostage takers. Mr. Cameron explains how several facets of the holiday, the tree, Santa Claus gifts, have roots in religious tradition. His account would constitute perhaps 10 minutes of conventional screen time, but Saving Christmas has been minimally edited." And then it goes on to talk about the rambling introduction, the pregnant pauses, the breaking the fourth wall constantly. Oh, he says, "Saving Christmas seems determined to win any perceived war on Christmas through brute force." So those are my thoughts then on it. Still, when you watch it, though, it's cringeworthy and bad. I would almost just go online just to watch the ending dance party. It does have some funny moments to it there. But I hope you enjoyed this episode. Just my top five. So bad, they're good Christian films. Maybe I'll do a future episode where I'll talk about top five Christian films that are amazing and everybody should see, because they are out there and I highly recommend them, whether they're made by Christians or, ironically enough, there are amazing Christian films that have been made by non-Christians, because Christians got to get your act together here. So I hope this is an enjoyable free-for-all Friday for you. I'll post links to the trailers for these films at trendhornpodcast.com so you can go and see them for yourselves. Enjoy the weekend, everyone, and I hope that you have a very blessed day.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trendhornpodcast.com.